Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising. This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Valerie Sanderson, and in the early hours of Friday, the 7th of June, these are our main stories. More details emerge from Sudan surrounding the deaths of civilians at the hands of paramilitary forces as the country is suspended from the African Union. Thousands of lawyers march through Hong Kong in protest as the government proposes extraditing criminal suspects to mainland China. Russia says its contributions to World War II are being overlooked as the Western world marks 75 years since D-Day. Also in this podcast, how is your dog feeling today? New research suggests that humans' anxiety can be felt by their canine companions. It's been weeks since the army generals ruling Sudan promised to hand power over to a civilian-led council and agreed the country should move towards free elections over the next 3 years. But talks between the military and opposition leaders stalled and the situation deteriorated, culminating in dozens of protesters being killed by security forces and a paramilitary group this week. Now, the African Union has stepped in, saying it's suspending Sudan's membership of the Pan-African grouping until a civilian transitional authority is in place. The BBC's Catherine Biarahanga is in the Sudanese capital, Khartoum.
The African Union had seemed willing to give Sudan's military rulers time to hand power to a civilian authority. Mande's violence appears to have changed that. Suspension from the organization and threats of sanctions could shift the general's thinking. They have been blocking the internet since Monday's massacre, but information is slowly emerging about the extent of the attacks on civilians. This mobile phone footage shows a group of men dressed in the RSF paramilitary's uniforms shooting and beating up protesters. Their leader denies his men committed the crimes, but 25-year-old Ahmed was there.
They took high ground with snipers and they started shooting at people. So people started running. I didn't know where I was going, if it's safe or not, I don't know. I was just running.
International groups, including Amnesty International and Christian Aid, have condemned the continuing violence against civilians. The British Minister of State for Africa, Harriet Baldwin, says the situation is unacceptable.
There are credible reports that in these attacks, which are absolutely sickening, that some 100 peaceful protesters have been killed. Bodies have been found in the Nile. There are reports of rape on some of the protesters. This is completely barbaric, and we have summoned the Sudanese ambassador to insist that this must stop.
Tomorrow, the Prime Minister of Ethiopia, a key neighbouring state, arrives to try to mediate between the generals and activists. He has an increasingly difficult task on his hands.
Catherine Biarahanga in Sudan. Well, the BBC has spoken to three women who fled when paramilitaries attacked the protesters. They're now hiding in a house in Khartoum and asked us not to use either their names or their voices for fear of being identified. So we voiced up what they told us.
On Monday, we were all at the sit-in. We got a phone call from our friend that we should find a place to hide because hundreds and hundreds of pickups were on their way to attack. Then they started shooting. We were on the ground trying to hide from the live ammunition. They were standing at the exit door beating everybody who was running outside the room, brutally. Then they asked us to jump over barbed wire as they beat us. We reached a fenced area in the middle of the street where they told us to sit until the pickups arrived. And then the RSF soldiers said things like, "How about we just set them on fire?" Or, "How about we just let two of them go and kill the rest?" Or some of them would just give us eye gestures, like a sexual implication, you know? We didn't know where they were taking us. One of them told us, "Jump off the pickup and run as fast as you can." So that's what we did. And as we were running, they opened fire.
"I cannot believe that we are out of there alive, or not sexually assaulted, or not buried alive somewhere. Every second of what was happening, I thought we would die."
They made some of us drink sewage water and they urinated on them. Part of the behaviour was coming from a very deep, dark place in their heads.
Three Sudanese women speaking to the BBC. Many people living in Hong Kong have expressed growing concern about Chinese laws, which they see as an erosion of the territory's legal autonomy. Now, plans to allow suspects to be extradited to mainland China have provoked outrage. And on Thursday, several thousand lawyers marched silently through Hong Kong to express their opposition to the idea. Our Asia Pacific editor Michael Brister reports.
At the moment, criminal suspects are not surrendered to the Chinese mainland. The territory's government says this makes Hong Kong a haven for criminals and wants the rules changed. It says this is a loophole in the legal system. But lawyers point out that the lack of an extradition treaty with mainland China is not a loophole. Previous administrations decided they didn't want to send suspects over the border because of a fear they would not receive a fair trial and could be tortured. Here's what one lawyer on the march said.
This bill is so rushed, no due process, no proper consultation whatsoever, and there's no human rights protections in the bill to enable judges to decide whether the requesting countries is up to the standard of human rights and the rule of law.
Some believe the changes are being brought in at Beijing's request to scare people in Hong Kong with the possibility of being sent to the mainland if they speak out against the Chinese government. Another lawyer on the protest said if the plans were approved, no one living, working or even passing through Hong Kong would be safe.
Michael Bristow. Thursday marked 75 years since D-Day, when the armed forces of Britain, the United States, Canada and their allies landed on the beaches of northern France. The invasion of Normandy was the first step towards liberating Europe from the Nazi forces of Adolf Hitler. The sight over the past 24 hours of veterans and political leaders from around the world attending ceremonies side by side has been a poignant reminder of the Allies' collective bravery and sacrifice during World War II. But one member of that alliance, Russia, wasn't invited to the commemoration, and it sparked a backlash, as our Moscow correspondent Steve Rosenberg reports.
When countries argue about the present, often they disagree too about the past. This week, Russian TV complained that Russia hadn't been invited to the D-Day commemorations. There wouldn't even have been a Normandy landing, the presenter noted, if it hadn't been for the Soviet soldiers who died from 1941 onwards in the fight against fascism. Russia feels unfairly left out of the D-Day remembrance and that its contribution to defeating the Nazis is being downplayed. Today, Russia's most popular newspaper posed this question. Why does the West want everyone to think that their front wasn't just the second front, but the main one? It added that millions of Soviet soldiers had been killed while the USSR waited for the Allies to open up a second front. And Foreign Ministry spokesperson Maria Zakharova told reporters that while Moscow honours the memory of all those who were killed on the second front in Europe, we should not exaggerate its role or belittle the titanic efforts of the USSR, without which victory would not have been achieved. She claimed that historians had concluded the Normandy landings did not have a decisive impact on the outcome of World War II. Such words are likely to upset veterans of D-Day, but they reflect less the past and much more the current tension between Russia and the West.
Steve Rosenberg. The Stonewall riots, 6 days of mass protest sparked when police raided a gay bar in New York City, are considered to be the birth of the modern LGBT rights movement in the US. Now, just weeks before the 50th anniversary of the uprising, the New York Police Department has made a formal apology for their raid. The BBC's Nick Bryant has more on the NYPD's actions that night in 1969.
In the early hours of June the 28th, 1969, they descended upon the Stonewall Bar in the Greenwich Village part of the city to enforce laws that in those days made it illegal to serve alcohol to known homosexuals. Now, it was commonplace for the police at that time to target gay bars in this way, but on this occasion, the officers were met with angry resistance, and this angry resistance actually turned into days of rioting, and the Stonewall Uprising ended up becoming the crucible moment of the modern-day LGBT rights movement. Now, the police commissioner, James P. O'Neill, said what happened should not have happened. He said the actions taken by the NYPD were wrong, plain and simple. The actions and the laws were discriminatory and oppressive. For that, I apologise. The police commissioner didn't do this in a kind of ceremonial way. It was slipped into a fairly routine police briefing, but he has delivered that official apology after 50 years. It has finally come. And I think for some people in the LGBT community, this will give them a sense of closure for what they've always thought was very heavy-handed policing, enforcing what were obviously discriminatory laws.
Nick Bryant reporting. Coming up on this podcast, global health officials say 1 million new cases of sexually transmitted infections occur every single day.
The World Health Organization says this is a wake-up call to ensure that everyone can access treatment, especially given that safe sex measures, alongside good education around sexual health, that can prevent most cases.
The head of African football is arrested on corruption charges. Thousands of people have taken part in Jerusalem's 18th annual LGBT Pride event, a parade strongly opposed by conservative religious groups. In 2015, an ultra-Orthodox Jew stabbed to death a 16-year-old marcher and wounded five others. This year's parade in the Holy City was met with protests and flanked by security. BBC's Yolande Nel is in Jerusalem.
It's late afternoon and thousands of people have already gathered here at Jerusalem's Liberty Bell Park for this march celebrating gay pride and tolerance.
It's an important place to show up and show your support, and it's important to show that it's okay to be who you are. And Jerusalem is different than Tel Aviv. I mean, Tel Aviv is like a big party, but here people are a little more serious. So even though, you know, you see the kids dancing.
In Israel, civil marriages aren't legal, let alone gay marriages, and making political change is difficult, especially with recent coalition governments made up of right-wing, nationalist and religious Jewish parties. What rights would you like to see for gay people in Israel?
Surrogacy, gay marriage, of course. These are the two things that are really missing.
There are plenty of rainbows drawn on people's faces all around me, they're on people's shirts, and there are flags too on display, although Jerusalem's chief rabbi had asked the local council not to hang them up. But to encounter more vocal anti-gay sentiment, I've just got to cross the road. People here are chanting, it's not pride, it's obscenity. This is a protest organised by a far-right group, and there are signs around me, Jerusalem is not Sodom, stop the LGBT terror. Now the Pride March is on the move, we're advancing up the road. There's a heavy police presence here, even a helicopter overhead. And this is why we're now passing the spot where 15-year-old Shira Banki was stabbed to death just 4 years ago at the Pride Parade. Shockingly, her attacker, an ultra-Orthodox man, had only just left prison after serving 10 years for stabbing people at the 2005 march. Now, while the anthem of this march is all about celebrating diversity, you don't see many Palestinian Jerusalemites here. One reason is the social taboo around homosexuality. But some accuse Israel of pinkwashing, highlighting gay rights at events like this, while neglecting Palestinian rights. Still, Adam decided to come today.
I'm an Arab Muslim guy who's always lived like in a very, not very open society. This means the world to me because I've never, ever, I've never even dreamed of doing something like this, like marching in a pride where I can just be myself.
It's 18 years since the first Jerusalem march, and there have been big advances for the local gay community in that time. But in this holy city, today's march is also a reminder of some of the deep divisions that aren't going away.
The World Health Organization say that an estimated 1 million new incidents of sexually transmitted infections, or STIs, occur every single day. Since the last global survey 6 years ago, health experts say there's been little progress in reducing the number of cases of the four most common infections, including syphilis and gonorrhea. Our health correspondent Dominic Hughes told me more about the million new cases and what that finding means.
It doesn't mean individuals, it means cases. So some unfortunate people will become infected with more than one sexually transmitted infection, or STI as they're also known. But still, those numbers are pretty staggering. And the researchers say that there has been little change since a similar survey was carried out in 2012. So as a result, the World Health Organization that funded this research says this is a wake-up call to ensure that everyone can access treatment, especially given that safe sex measures, including using a condom alongside good education around sexual health, that can prevent most cases.
So why are the figures so high then? Is it a case of stigma or ignorance or all sorts of things?
I think it's all of those things. It's a lack of political will sometimes in countries to finance research. It's cultural issues around sexual health and sex education. Sometimes the money just isn't there to finance these projects. All of these sexually transmitted infections are preventable through safe sex practices, including what's called the correct and consistent use of a condom and sexual health education. So countries where these kind of programs struggle to get funding or indeed sort of political support, they're going to face growing problems. The other big weapon in the armory for reducing the number of cases is testing, and that's testing that can be done quickly and affordably, and a screening program for people who are sexually active. And again, in those countries where the infrastructure to support this or the funding just isn't there, or there's a cultural or political problem with that, those programs, they're going to struggle. But there's this other issue too in the background. All these what are called bacterial STIs of the kind we're talking about, they can be treated and cured with widely available drugs. But recently, there's been a shortage in the global supply of a particular type of penicillin that has made it much more difficult to treat syphilis in particular. And on top of this, there's a rapidly increasing antimicrobial resistance to gonorrhea treatments. That is also a growing health threat, and that could lead eventually to the disease becoming impossible to treat. These diseases can have a devastating impact on people's lives. They can lead to stillbirths, infertility, neurological and heart disease, and an increased risk of HIV. And all of those can have a really profound impact. Syphilis alone is responsible for thousands of early births and deaths among very small children.
Dominic Hughes. In France, football's world governing body FIFA has confirmed that the head of African football, Ahmed Ahmed, has been arrested in Paris on the eve of the start of the Women's World Cup. Our sports news editor, Alex Capstick, is following developments from Paris.
He is here in Paris for the FIFA Congress, which happened yesterday when Gianni Infantino was re-elected as president of FIFA, and for the start of the Women's World Cup, which takes place here in France over the next month or so. We understand he was detained by French police, and it's in relation to allegations related to his time as president of CAF. He was named president in 2017. He beat Issa Hayatou, who'd been in charge for 29 years, in a vote of the members. It was a bit of a surprise, and when he joined, he promised to make the organisation more modern, to make it more transparent. But we do know that FIFA had begun an ethics investigation into him earlier this year after a former senior official alleged that the president had been involved in bribes and misusing hundreds of thousands of dollars. And one of those allegations concerned a sportswear firm that he didn't deal with based in France. As I say, we don't quite know what the French are talking to him about. Ahmed denied all those allegations, but this is not great timing for FIFA on the eve of such a big tournament.
Alex Capstick. If you're feeling overcome by a stressful day, a glance at your dog's expectant face and wagging tail can brighten the worst of moods. Now, new research has shown what many dog owners feel to be true, that your dog soaks up your mood. I asked Lena Roth, a scientist who studies animal behaviour and who led the work at Linköping University in Sweden, how she measured the way dogs mirror the stress levels of their owners.
We actually cut some hairs from the neck of the dog and the head of the owner and took a couple of centimeter of hair and extracted the cortisol from that, because cortisol is integrated in the hair as it grows. So then you actually get a long-term stress level from these centimeters of hair. So this is a very promising and good method to measure your long-term stress.
So the higher the cortisol, the higher your stress.
Exactly. The higher your general stress level is, both owners and dogs. In this study, we used Shetland sheepdogs and border collies. So these are herding dogs, both selected to cooperate with humans. So, of course, they are very attentive to all our signals. So maybe that is one of the reasons why they synchronize so strongly with us.
And do you find that anxious dogs create anxious owners?
So what we did in this study was that we actually asked owners to complete questionnaires about the personality, both of themselves and their dogs. The owner's personality had a quite big influence on the dog's hair cortisol, while the dog's personality did not. And it was especially one personality trait that influenced both our hair samples, and that was neuroticism. And there we actually saw that if the owners had higher scores on neuroticism, they had dogs with lower hair cortisol levels. If you have a high score for neuroticism, then you might use your dog as a social supporter more than other personality types.
And what's the message from this study, do you think, to dog owners?
That we have a great relationship and a unique bond with our dogs, and interaction between the dog and the owner has a great impact and positive impact on our relationship and synchronization. So I guess just be with your dog in a positive way that you both appreciate.
Mm-hmm. And thereby hangs a tale. Lena Roth in Sweden. And that's it from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Valerie Sanderson. Until next time, bye-bye.